Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It is that time of year. The leaves on trees are turning to yellow and red. We're dusting off our cold weather jackets and pulling out our snow boots in the event of an early snow. The NFL is deep in the month of pink, and there are only 80-some-odd days of shopping before Christmas. How are you doing on that task? Invariably, this is also the time of year when we hear numerous stories about the conflict over nativity scenes on the lawn of City Hall, or some school banning Christmas concerts and instead substituting in winter solstice festivals. Many Christians consider such events to be an infringement upon their religious freedom, the ability to publicly proclaim and celebrate their faith. Given that my own research agenda deals with the issue of religious liberty, I figured now would be as good of a time as any to look at some of these controversies. But more than just addressing the perennial Merry Christmas controversies as they manifest themselves in either the public square or in private businesses, I also think it would be a good time to take an inventory of other cases involving threats to religious liberty, a theme we frequently visit on our show. Many of us have probably heard of the Hobby Lobby controversy that is winding its way through our federal court system, involving the rights of conscience of a privately held company and whether or not they can be required to provide medical insurance for things that violate their beliefs, such as contraception and abortifacient drugs. But is this the only case of its kind? And beyond the realm of healthcare mandates, are there other issues lurking on the horizon that are challenging long-held notions of religious freedom? To discuss these concerns, I am pleased to be joined today by David Cortman. David serves as Senior Counsel and Vice President of Litigation with Alliance Defending Freedom, formerly known as Alliance Defense Fund. He is in charge of all direct litigation efforts to protect religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and marriage and the family. He has been practicing constitutional law for more than 17 years and has successfully litigated nearly 200 cases at every level, including recent victories at the U.S. Supreme Court and federal courts of appeal. He is admitted to the bar in Georgia, Florida, Arizona, and Washington, D.C., and he joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me. Good to be here.
David, I kind of noticed that you don't have that wonderful Southern Georgian accent. What's the deal there?
I do not. I am one of those, like many others, that decided brushing off our winter jackets and taking out our snow boots was not something we enjoyed doing too often. So we moved down to the South. And so I'm one of those who've been in the Atlanta area for about 15 years now from the Northeast.
Okay. So no snow boots for you and no Georgian accent, I guess. Hmm?
That's right. We just like to visit the snow in little bits and pieces.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it. I have another thing before we get things rolling that I have to ask you about, and that's your recent name change. And that's yours, because I think you've been David Cortman ever since you were born, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, but it's with your organization. A few years back, I interviewed Eric Stanley of the Alliance Defense Fund. But I noticed, a few months back, maybe 7 or 8 months ago, that ADF now stood for Alliance Defending Freedom. What's going on with the name change there?
Well, it was one of those things where we were noticing that our name did not communicate what we did very well. In fact, we'd tell someone, you know, I work with Alliance Defense Fund, and they'd say, well, what is that? Are you a defense contractor? You have a mutual fund. What exactly do you do? And so we actually revisited the name for that purpose. And so we believe that Alliance Defending Freedom more accurately defines what we do. We're an alliance of like-minded individuals and groups. We have over 2,000 allied attorneys that are like-minded that work with us in several hundred groups. And we defend freedom, religious liberty, marriage and the family, and pro-life causes. And so that was the main reason for the name change.
I guess it does. And it's fortunate that you found something that says ADF for both of them, because then you probably didn't have to change the acronyms on the doors or anything, right?
Well, we did exactly. That was one of the goals, is to keep the acronym the same.
Yeah.
Although we did get a shiny new logo and a different type of brand, but still, you're exactly right.
Very good. One other personal question too. I noticed when I read your biography that it said you have recently appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court and litigated cases there. What court cases did you do up there?
Well, we're actually involved in one we'll talk about later, which is the Greece case. We're co-counsel in the case that the court will be hearing coming up in November in a few weeks. But we also litigated a few years ago a court case called Arizona Christian School Tuition Organization versus Wynn, and it was about several issues, but one of them was school choice programs. And so the issue was there were some groups that were challenging some school choice programs. As you know, across the country, states have enacted many types of programs, and one is what's called a tuition tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can donate to a private 501c3 group, and then they give your donations to different private schools of all different types and brands. And there were a few taxpayers that objected because they didn't like the fact that some of that money went to religious schools and thought it violated the Establishment Clause. And so we got involved in that case, defended the program, and got a victory there based on the inability of taxpayers to be able to complain under the Establishment Clause because they had no legal injury. And so it was a good victory for religious freedom.
What does that mean, they had no legal injury?
Well, what that basically means is that in order for someone to go to court, they have to have some sort of an injury that's happened to them, some sort of violation of their rights. So no one can go to court just for any reason. You have to have some sort of a personal injury. Well, if you're a taxpayer and you say, well, I don't like the way the government runs, which many of us do not, that doesn't mean you have a right just to go into court and complain how they spend your money or what they do with tax money. And so there's been this exception over the years for the Establishment Clause, religion-type cases, where anyone can go into court and say, well, gee, I don't like what the government does. I'm a taxpayer, and I'm going to sue. And so our basic allegation was, no, you have to have a personal violation. It can't be this broad. I don't like what the government does, and so shouldn't be able to bring the case in the first place. And the Supreme Court agreed, and we had a victory in that case.
It sounds like that case has implications not only for religious liberty, but also for secular court cases as well.
It absolutely does, and some of the principles we'll talk about today have those same widespread ramifications, not only in the religious liberty context, but in other types of areas too. So you're absolutely right.
I have to ask this on a personal level too, because this always fascinates me when I tour the different places in Washington, D.C. They're oftentimes very intimidating. Was it kind of scary to go up there and argue before the Supreme Court justices?
Well, you know, ironically enough, I'm probably one of the few attorneys that won a Supreme Court case and never actually got to argue, and it's interesting how that all worked out. It was our case. They granted what they call certiorari. They granted our case, and there were the state was arguing, and then the Solicitor General, who gets to come in on any case they want to, is arguing, and the court normally only allows two parties per side to argue, and of course, we were number three on the list. So the irony of it was they took our case, they ruled on that standing issue we just spoke about, but we weren't permitted to argue, just file the briefing. And so they took our case, they ruled on our case, we won in our case, but didn't get the opportunity to argue. But it's very when you go there, it's very daunting. The courtroom is very quaint, but very high ceilings. The justices come out behind this big curtain. It's very ominous when you go in there, so you're absolutely right. And I think they make it that way on purpose.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Having never done that before, I've always wondered what that would be like. Well, let's go ahead and start talking about some of these cases. You briefly mentioned the Arizona Christian School case, and we do want to get to some of these big cases, the healthcare mandate type of cases. But before we get to those weightier cases, you folks are dealing with a couple cases that are interesting to me, the things that I call the invariable Christian controversies that pop up around this time every year. And one came to my attention because it occurred in my former home state of Wisconsin. So apparently, up there in Wausau, Wisconsin, at Wausau West High School, there was a group of choir singers. I guess they considered themselves elite choir singers, and they wanted to do works of the masters for a forthcoming winter concert. And this included some Christian content, which the school board promptly put the kibosh on. What all happened there?
Yeah, and it's one of those things, as you mentioned, it's been happening for many years where you have this misinformation that's put out there. And people have, I think, these knee-jerk reactions, and a lot of times it happens in public schools where they think because there's something religious automatically it's banned or should be censored in the public schools, and that's simply not the case. And here they were given some bad advice based on what we hear so often from groups on the left about the so-called separation of church and state, that they decided, well, we can't have any religious music as part of our Christmas concert, and so we're just going to say, well, two things. Number one, either don't have any more of these concerts at all, or we'll do some sort of a ratio where for every Christian song you have for Christmas, you have to have at least four secular Christmas songs. And so I guess the point is that waters it down enough where it's not religious anymore or something of that nature. And so that was the advice they gave and the orders they gave to their schools. And so these choirs and as you said, these master singers with these advanced choirs would go around and sing. They all of a sudden now could not sing any songs about Christmas anymore. And so that's certainly not in accordance with the Constitution. And that's why we decided to get involved and send a letter.
You sent a letter, and that is interesting in and of itself, because that seemed to have solved the problem. It didn't have to go to court or anything. How did that work out?
Well, it worked out well, because one of the biggest problems here is educating people on what the law really is. You know, we get so many of these scare tactics and this political correctness run amok these days that people really don't know what they're allowed to do or not allowed to do. And so we sent a letter that said, look, you know, whatever advice you're getting, it's not correct. We sent them case law and a legal analysis that basically said, when you're performing religious songs as part of a Christmas concert or whatever it happens to be, and you're presenting them objectively as part of this program of education, because as we know, much art, much music has religious themes, that's absolutely constitutional, and every court that has ruled upon it has said so. So who's ever given you this legal advice, you know, look at these type of cases. And so when you educate people, much of the time that's enough to put their fears at rest, because sometimes they're being threatened with lawsuits from groups on the left, like, you know, ACLU or Freedom for Religion Foundation and groups like that. But once they realize that they're on firm constitutional footing, then they decide to allow these programs to go on as they should.
So you mentioned that there's a lot of case law behind this. Is this pretty much settled law that if a school district out here or some kids in a school out here said, I want to go ahead and sing Holy Night or something at a concert, they can do that no problem? Is that settled law, or is this still pretty contentious?
No, it's settled law, but it's still contentious. And the reason for that is you have groups with agenda that, even though it is settled law, will continue to attack it until they could find maybe a court that rules against them or something getting reversed. But it really is settled law, and on two different fronts, because you bring up, for example, a student singing. Mm-hmm. There's both, if a student wants to perform, for example, in a talent show or something like that, or distribute religious literature, or we have cases with schools have banned kids from saying the word Easter or passing out Easter flyers, or passing out invitations to a church party for Christmas. There's not only does the student have a right to engage in that speech, but the school itself has a right to, as we mentioned, sing religious Christmas carols along with secular ones in their Christmas concert, not their winter solstice concert. So there's plenty of law supporting both the school's right to do so and obviously the student's right to do so.
Yeah, you still hear all these controversies, though, that somebody is asked, bring in your favorite book for show and tell, and somebody brings in a Bible and everybody freaks out. Is this one of these widespread problems? Are different groups trying to just pick every single possible case they can, either because the school district doesn't know or just because they are hoping to get a favorable courtroom ruling and say, aha, precedence?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think a lot of it is again, misinformation, and a lot of it's just flat-out hostility. There are people that want to make sure that there is no acknowledgement of religion, there's none of our religious heritage, nothing religious in the public square. Censorship, you know, cleansing, sandblasting, whatever we have to do to get rid of any of our religious heritage, we'll do. And so these groups get very, very aggressive. They write letters almost on a daily basis. Anything they read in the paper across the country, they'll send a demand letter and saying, if you don't remove this religious practice or religious acknowledgement, that we will threaten to sue you in court. And so this is happening on literally a daily basis all across the country. Wow. For things as minor as a song or calling something Christmas instead of winter solstice. And that bleeds down to not only violating the Constitution for what it says, but also goes further to then violate the rights of individual students, who then the school says, well, we can't do it, neither can you. And we have many cases like that throughout the year, not only during Christmas holiday time.
You know, this case in Wausau, Wisconsin, it seems to be indicative of a lot of cases around this time of year. You mentioned you get these things on a daily basis. And I have some mixed feelings about them, especially the ones that involve whether or not the city hall should have a nativity scene on its front lawns. And again, I would bet within the next month, we're going to hear one or two cases that pop up in the media about this thing. I tend to be a little bit separationist on this issue, in part because I really don't want government endorsing my Christian faith. If I go to the city hall, I want them to keep the streets clean, keep the burglars out of the town, and maybe issue a permit for me to build a shed on my property or something. I don't want them saying this is Christianity, because that's what I do, and that's what my faith community, my church does. Granted, I don't want them regulating what I can do as part of that faith organization either, but I'm not really concerned about whether or not there's a nativity scene on the lawn. But nonetheless, a lot of my evangelical friends really get their hackles up when it comes to this. And I'm just wondering, you know, from your perspective, and you deal with these quite a bit, and especially the nativity on the city hall lawn thing, to what extent are these nativity battles on city hall lawn really important?
Well, the reason I think they are important is because they're indicative of what's going on as a culture. If you could put it in a vacuum and say, you know, does this one particular instance of whether a certain city has a nativity scene on their lawn or not matter? And you could say, well, there are much more important things going on than that, and that's fine. The problem, though, is it's not in a vacuum. It's not in isolation. It's a part of a pattern that's been going on for many, many years now. And the problem is it moves from a religious acknowledgement or accommodation that the government is allowed to do and should be doing for its own citizens, and it moves over into censorship or hostility. And I think that's the problem. So it's indicative of a bigger picture of we don't want the nativity scene, even though it's Christmas time, and you know that's what Christmas is. It's the birth of Christ. You may not celebrate it, and that's okay, but it's Christmas time. And most people enjoy the Christmas trees and Santa Claus, and certainly the nativity scene is part of that. And that's fine, and it should be fine. But there's a difference between the political question of should we have this there, and does it violate the Constitution? Mm-hmm. And the first answer is political. That's up to the community to decide if they want to do it, but it certainly is constitutional to have it there. My concern is that when you add all that together, does it matter in and of itself? Well, if you add that to removing Christmas from schools, both the school singing any Christmas songs or the student, we have several cases. One we just won out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is right below the Supreme Court, where a student was not allowed to pass out a flyer inviting some of her friends to a Christmas party because it took place at a church. And so we're moving into this, well, it's okay now to it's the censorship and hostility. And that's the problem is in the bigger picture, it's going on in all aspects of life where we have this complete censorship of anything religious in the public square. And that's simply not what the Constitution calls for.
And it certainly seems to be giving rise to this culture of hair trigger insults, that anything that you do or say is it automatically going to create, I guess, is what you know, lawyers would say, personal injury that would, you know, have me sobbing under my bed for weeks on end, and it must not tolerate. But if you don't stop it somewhere, I guess it would just lead everywhere.
Well, that's exactly right. And the case I talked about before about that standing, whether you have an injury, there's an issue that sometimes courts allow there. It's called the offended observer, and it's just what you said. I don't like what I see, and so therefore my rights are violated because my feelings are hurt. That's it. My feelings are hurt, nothing else. And so you should have to remove this religious X, whatever it happens to be, Ten Commandments monument, this nativity scene, this Christmas song that happens to be religious among the other ones. And so we have then these what they call eggshell plaintiffs, where someone who's just, well, I don't like that, I should be able to get rid of it. Well, the problem is if it doesn't violate the Constitution, which in these cases it does not, then there's no right not to be offended. In fact, that's the great thing about our country is the free speech protection we have here. Sometimes you're going to hear things you may not agree with, but the answer to speech you don't like is more speech, not censorship. And I think that's the way these things should be handled.
Yeah, very good. I like that term, eggshell plaintiff, just somebody who crumbles immediately on any kind of offense, I guess. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, this gets to another issue that you guys are involved in right now, and it's one that involves prayer before a city council meeting. So maybe nativity scene on the city hall lawn to say, hey, this is our Christian heritage is one thing. But all of a sudden, somebody praying before a legislative assembly in a city, and in this case, it's Greece, New York, that is causing some problems. Are we dealing with the same kind of issues here? What's the nature of this case that's going on in Greece, New York right now?
Well, you know, it's another interesting question because we talk about the, you know, the religious heritage of our country. This type of prayer goes back to, in fact, the founding of our country, but even before then. So it absolutely is similar in that tone. And what we have is we have towns all across the United States, thousands of them, who knows how many, that engage in a quick prayer before they open their city council meetings, town council meetings, state legislators, Congress, every level of the legislative branch. And so you have prayers that are been said. Sometimes they have a chaplain, sometimes they invite people from the community, and that's what you hear. This small town in Greece, New York, a suburb of Rochester in upstate New York, and you talk about cold winters, they certainly get them there.
Yeah.
But you have this prayer that goes on, and what they do is they invite anyone from the community and say, look, if someone wants to give a message, an opening prayer, an invocation, all you have to do is sign up. First come, first serve. You're allowed in. We're not going to tell you what to say. We're not going to tell you what not to say. You pray or not according to the dictates of your own conscience. And so what do we get? We get two people who happen to hear one of those prayers that are offended by it. They don't like it. So do they sign up and say, well, I don't like this, so I'm going to speak next time and give some other sort of welcome? No, what they do is they file a lawsuit along with Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and basically say, I shouldn't have to be offended, I shouldn't have to listen to this, and therefore it's unconstitutional, and you shouldn't engage in these prayers any longer.
Let me play devil's advocate here for a minute and argue from their side of the coin, because I can imagine if I walked into a city council meeting and there's some important issue before the city council, and all of a sudden I hear somebody praying to Jesus and say, Jesus, please deliver us this issue. It's very important for our community. And all of a sudden there's a lot of other churchgoers along their sides cheering and clapping. And I'm on the other side of the issue. So it might be the zoning regulation for a church building or something. I say, well, I don't really want this here. I might feel really intimidated and want to back away, which, you know, maybe affects my ability to use the political system there. There's this subtle coercion, I would guess. Is that the case? Is that part of the reason that they're arguing this case, or what other basis might they be arguing this on?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things. And one of them is that type of coercion you just mentioned. And it's interesting because while the plaintiffs in the case, and one of them is an atheist, but while the plaintiffs in the case are saying exactly what you just said, oh, we're kind of intimidated, and we feel bad having to sit there, and we don't want to really listen to the prayer or participate in the prayer. What's interesting is publicly speaking, they object to it during the public hearing. They make their voice known. They file a lawsuit. So what's interesting, they're timid and coercive on paper, but in real life, they're really not. And my point about that is it goes back to being offended. If in our country, we should be able to hear all things, including prayers, that we may not agree with. So the difference is, though, it's not tied to your participation in the government. It has nothing to do with your status. It has nothing to do with your zoning request. In fact, you don't even have to hear the prayer. You can come in after it's done if you really don't like it that much. Or you can go up and give your little message beforehand, or you can go to the public hearing part of it and just say, you know what, I'm not really crazy about these prayers, which, by the way, they've done. And so the question is, and again, I mentioned this before, the political question is, should we have this opening invocation? And that's done through the political process, and they can vote and have their voices heard. The constitutional question is it unconstitutional because we allow that? And the answer is no, not only based on past Supreme Court cases, but based on over 225 years of practice, as the gentleman who wrote the First Amendment, including the Establishment Clause, the so-called separation of church and state, were engaging in the same practice while they were writing the First Amendment. So it's pretty tough to argue that they were violating the very amendment that they were passing at that same time.
And what are some of the court cases that you would refer to when litigating this case, the ones that have set the precedent? You mentioned we got, you know, 235 some odd years of practice on this, but also there's court cases that have recently come about. Which ones really anchor this issue for you?
Well, there's one specific case called Marsh versus Chambers. It was ruled upon about 30 years ago, a little bit more, by the Supreme Court of the United States on this specific issue. So the court has already upheld the practice of what they call legislative prayer. And it basically said, look, this doesn't violate the Constitution. This was going on from the founding fathers and even before them. It was found in the First Continental Congress, in the First Congress of the United States, and has occurred continuously since then. So obviously it doesn't violate the same clause that was written at the same time. So in spite of that case, which is direct precedent, right on point, acknowledged by the district court, the lower court, but when it went up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and this is how the case becomes more interesting, the Second Circuit said, yes, we understand that there's a case out there where the Supreme Court ruled on this, but here we have a problem because there's too many Christians' prayers. There's too much Jesus going on here. And the response from us on behalf of the town was, well, that's just the demographics of the town. In the record is the town is like 90% Christian or something like that, so you're more likely going to get more Christian prayers. But if you had the same policy in New York City, obviously it would be a much different mix, and that would be fine too. And so the court said, no, you've got to do something about that. Maybe you should bus in people from other towns and from different religions. And so what do? You have a religious gerrymander. You take a poll. What religion are you? Christian. No, that's no good. But okay, you can pray and make sure you pray this way. Well, the government shouldn't have that type of entanglement in telling people how to pray or who to pray to. And so it just creates more problems than it fixes, as opposed to just letting whoever lives in the community come and volunteer on a neutral basis.
Yeah, that raises the issue. You said there's too much Jesus in this. And what would happen if somebody made the argument, and this frequently happens, say, okay, fine, you can pray to Jesus, but we got to give everybody else their due say. And so now you got to bring in somebody who's Jewish, somebody who's Muslim, somebody who's Buddhist. Of course, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster has to come in. And pretty soon we have 5 hours of prayers at the city council meeting, and we can't get to the city council business. And it just seems, from a economic standpoint of trying to be efficient with the use of time, it would just seem that having everybody give their fair share would just create such problems. And so why just not have nobody gets to pray?
Right. Well, there's an easy answer to that is you sign up for one prayer per meeting. So anybody can come and pray, and as you sign up, you get the next meeting and the meeting that follows, and so you wouldn't spend 5 hours in prayer. You would just have your one type of prayer. But the other thing is this policy, everybody is allowed to pray. So, in fact, there have been prayers from the Baha'i faith. There's been prayers from Jewish rabbis. There's been prayers from a Wiccan even prayed. And so it is open to anybody that's in the community. And so you do get that same flavor. Whatever community is made up where your prayer happens to be, everybody gets to come on a neutral basis. And so there doesn't represent all those problems. It's a pretty easy way to take care of it, especially with a policy like this.
I have to step outside of the legal issues here for a minute and just ask you, because you've dealt with these issues before, is how have Christians been taking to this? Now, if the Greece case, if they win and it says, oh, we can pray at the Greece City Council, they probably go yay. But, you know, I've seen instances, and I know some of my friends, that if a Muslim came up and prayed in our local city council meeting, they would just completely lose it. Say, why are you letting this person do it? Is part of this whole package of promoting religious freedom for Christians to pray at Greece City Council, does that get packaged in with, hey, you got to let this for everybody else, so, you know, you Christians got to settle down a little bit?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that is you know, part of what we do when we go to court for cases like this and we defend religious freedom, the great part about it is if we're successful here, which I think we will be, it does protect everybody's religious freedom. And that's what's great about our country. And if you look at, you know, the protections that we have under the First Amendment, both the free speech and free exercise clauses, everybody falls under that. So everybody receives the same protection. And so the short answer is yes, is everybody gets the benefit, because what's great about America is you can believe whatever you want or not believe anything, but everyone's protected nonetheless. The question is, because there may be some people who are atheists or don't believe, should they then be able to silence everybody else or remove any accommodation of religion or remove our religious history or our religious heritage? I mean, think about this for a second. What they really want in this case is no public prayer at all. But even they understand that's a pretty extreme position, because not only has the Supreme Court said it's fine, but it's been going on since the founding of our country. And so they know that's extreme, so they say, well, tell you what, let's just make it what they call non-sectarian. So you can't pray to any specific deity. Well, if you're not praying to your God, whoever that happens to be, you're really not praying at all. And so what they're trying to do is get about something indirectly that they know they can't accomplish directly. And it's pretty extreme to say, look, we don't want any religious acknowledgement to be anywhere in our country. So if you go to Washington, D.C., you're going to be sandblasting monuments, Lincoln Memorial, Supreme Court, no prayers, no Ten Commandments. And it really undoes the history of our country. And I think that's the problem where these cases go by those who bring these challenges.
Yeah. Very interesting take on that. Let's move away from Greece City Council here and talk about another case that has been winding its way through the courts nowadays. And it's actually not just one case, but it's a set of cases, I believe. Then they've received a lot more attention recently because of the passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, oftentimes referred to as Obamacare, that the Affordable Care Act has implemented a number of regulatory mandates. And these are not legislative laws. These are coming from the Department of Health and Human Services about how the law will actually be implemented. How this applies to religious institutions, including colleges, is obviously a big point of contention, right? Can churches be mandated to do things that violate their own conscience? Can a religious university like Notre Dame be mandated to do that? But this is also affecting private businesses. Hobby Lobby is the big name player involved here, but it's really affecting a wide array of businesses, is it not?
It is. And what's interesting now is Alliance Defending Freedom now represents, I think we're litigating about 12 of these type of cases. And as you mentioned, it's much broader. I think there's close to 75 cases now that have been filed with over 200 plaintiffs. But that's exactly the point. The point is what the government is arguing in these cases, that if you are a person of faith, if you're a Christian, and you go into business, you lose your constitutional protections. And so the religious freedom that you have, if you decide to go into business, you lose it. In fact, the argument they make is that you cannot exercise religion as part of your business. Well, that comes to news to many people across the country. And you mentioned Hobby Lobby, which are run by the Green family. Great people, Christians. They've run their business in accordance with their faith. They're very generous, not only to their community, but to charitable institutions. They take care of the employees. And another case is the Conestoga Wood case, which is the Hahn family that we represent. Great family, Mennonites. It's been in the family for 50 years. All generations are working there. They do handcrafted woodworking for cabinets and kitchens and things like that. And these are families that operate their businesses specifically according to their faith, yet the government wants to step in and say, the price of making a living for you is to violate your sincerely held religious beliefs, and we certainly don't think the government should be doing that.
Now, you mentioned the Hobby Lobby case, but you also mentioned this Conestoga Wood Specialties business that you folks are representing. And I'm not a lawyer, but I would like to figure out legal strategy here. Are these cases different in some way, or are they the same thing? And if they are the same thing, is there a strategy to keeping these cases separate, or should they be bundled together in order to be litigated all at once?
Well, what's interesting is that the cases are being litigated separately by different organizations in different parts of the country. But what has happened, though, is that now they're both asking the Supreme Court to review them. And so Hobby Lobby case went up, and they lost at the lower court. But then the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the level right below the Supreme Court, reversed and granted their injunction. So they have their relief that the mandate is not in effect against them. And then you take Conestoga Wood, which is over in Pennsylvania. They lost at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So we filed for the Supreme Court of the United States to take the Conestoga case, and the government filed for the Supreme Court to take the Hobby Lobby case. And so at some point, obviously, within the next couple of months, the Supreme Court is going to decide should they take either one and which one. But what's good about it is that if they take whichever case, the principle that'll be applied once they rule on that case should apply to, you know, the other party and others who are involved in this. So once they lay out what the rule is, and is the government allowed to violate your religious beliefs merely because you go into business, which we don't believe they should, it should put out a principle that applies more broadly.
Tell us a little bit about the Conestoga Wood case. How did this come onto your radar screen, and what were the people who owned the business? I think you called them the Hahn family, if?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. How did they decide, well, I'm just not going to roll over. I'm going to take this case up. And how did they end up finding ADF?
Well, what's great about this, I mentioned before that we have over 2,000 allied attorneys. And in fact, some of our allied attorneys, there's a gentleman, two gentlemen in Pennsylvania, Randy Winger with a group called the Independence Law Center and Chuck Proctor, who's with another firm there in Pennsylvania, have been working with this family for years, even before this case. And so they've been helping them with business types of issues. They're friends of the family. Well, when this mandate was put into operation, this Mennonite family said, look, you know, we take care of our employees, we have great health insurance, but we cannot violate our religious beliefs by supplying for or paying for insurance that offers these abortion-inducing drugs, because that ends a human life, and we certainly can't participate because that violates our religious beliefs. And so these two gentlemen represented them and then brought in Alliance Defending Freedom when it got up to the Third Circuit after they ruled against them. And so we are actually working with them and taking the case up to the Supreme Court. So it's a great relationship that attorneys have had. But it was interesting. I went and flew out and met this family. And it's a great family that, you know, the dad and mom started the company 50 years ago. It's still run by the family. Now the kids are involved and put out a really high quality product. But what's so special about this family is that they're very simple people. They didn't cause this fight. They didn't bring it. It was brought to them. And that's one of the problems with this intrusive regulations by this administration, is they are now reaching into these families and their small businesses and dictating to them that they have to violate their religious beliefs in just the products that they purchase. And that's certainly unprecedented.
How big is the company?
The company has about a little over 900 employees.
Okay, so it's a pretty big one. It's a small size business. It's not a IBM or Boeing or anything like that, but it's got a number of employees, so I can see that this stuff will be on their radar screen. I just wonder to what extent there are other small businesses that are out there being affected in the same way, but really can't find help or assistance, and they either roll over or to these laws and regulations, or they just go out of business.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's one of the problems is that you'll have businesses. In fact, the law applies to businesses that have 50 employees, 50 or more employees, which is a pretty small business. And that's the problem is that if you had to pay for representation to go against the government, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, and these small businesses certainly can't afford that. And in fact, what's interesting, the fines that are associated with Obamacare, this abortion pill mandate, would put the Hans out of business within a month or two. If they had to pay $35 million a year for their company, wow, would put them out of business within 30 to 60 days if they were have to pay the fines for not violating their religious beliefs. And that's the choice that these companies are being put to. Either you violate your faith or you go out of business and you can't make a living. Well, that's certainly untenable and shouldn't be forced upon anybody, regardless of their beliefs.
Again, let me just play devil's advocate again here. Say, hey, you got the freedom to not take this stuff and pay the fine. And yes, it'll cost you $35 million, and that's a lot. But hey, why don't you just raise the price of your wood furniture?
Yeah, it's an interesting argument, because you basically say, yes, you have the freedom to comply with the mandate that we order you to or go out of business. I mean, that's not a choice, and it's not freedom. And since when, you know, we look at the government's role in this, and since when do they mandate businesses? And we, you know, talk about there's also the individual mandate, which is coming up soon, but they mandate people to buy a particular product, and especially one that violates their religious beliefs with no accommodation to it. And so to say, well, this is the price you pay for going in business to violate your beliefs, I think is just incredible. And people need to understand, in this case, it happens to be obviously abortion-inducing drugs, but if the government can force people of faith to do this, they can force anyone to violate their moral beliefs or whatever they stand for. And then the government starts dictating what you can and can't do, and that's dangerous regardless of where you are.
Yeah, it seems that it would be that case. And you just mentioned something that just popped into my head, too, that we're talking about businesses here with the Conestoga with 900 employees. Hobby Lobby has thousands of employees, a very big business. But this issue of the individual mandate, and again, that's starting to play itself out right now. And I'm wondering if there's any cases that are being raised where somebody says, okay, I have to buy insurance. My employee is not, or my employer is not buying it for me. And I go to one of these exchanges and here's policy A, policy B, policy C. And oh, buy all the, all these things cover abortion and I don't want to pay for that. Then I have to pay a fine. Is there anybody taking up a court case on behalf of an individual rather than a business or a company?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we're beginning, Alliance Defending Freedom is beginning those types of cases. It's what we call the next round of cases, because not only does this apply to people say, well, you're in business, you should have to abide by these rules, but it should never be the price of business to violate your faith. Because people have been in business for you know, since the beginning of our country that are Christians, and you can still employ those things. But imagine taking it down to the individual level, as you just mentioned. So not only are you forced to purchase insurance, even if you're young, even if you're healthy, even if you don't want it, you're forced to buy it or pay a penalty. And then when you do buy it, there is now being set up these individual abortion funds where you pay a specific amount to this fund that goes right to funding abortions. I mean, it's incredible. Whether you're a business or a person, you're forced to pay for abortions, even if it's against your beliefs. And I think, as I mentioned before, the government is simply taking this too far and penalizing citizens way beyond it ever has.
Yeah. There's some issues, too, beyond just the issues of religious freedom and violating one's conscience. And I think this is something that not only people of faith should be concerned about, but people who are not of a particular faith, atheists or agnostics. And it comes to this issue of how these regulatory mandates are being used. Now, I remember going back to my high school civics class, it's really the purview of the legislative branch to create laws. But we see with this Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, it's associated with this Health and Human Service mandate, which basically you get the Affordable Care Act making some seemingly vague laws, and then the Department of Health and Human Services comes in and hones these into very specifics. These are unelected bureaucrats who are making very specific rules that really affect behavior, and they are basically looking like laws. I mean, is there a bigger constitutional issue here that we're turning over the right of the legislature to make laws to these unelected bureaucrats?
Absolutely. And you hear it once in a while in the news where, for example, President Obama unilaterally say, well, we're going to delay this for the next year. Well, that's Congress's job. And so not only do we have the executive branch writing laws, and it's not only filling out the blanks, but this abortion pill mandate didn't come from Congress. In fact, every time it's come before Congress where people have tried to force this down Americans' throats, it's been voted against. So now we don't have Congress that enacts this law because the will of the people is not behind it. We have a fiat from the executive branch who just inserts it anyway. And so you're absolutely right. There's issues such as separation of powers and other types of constitutional issues where the executive branch is not supposed to be making the law. They're supposed to be carrying it out. It is Congress and the legislative branch that should be doing so. And that should concern everybody. Regardless of how you feel on this particular issue, that should worry everyone that now you have an executive branch that's now drafting the laws instead of the people that we elect to do so.
I remember when this was being debated in Congress and the contentious debate that was occurring around the abortion mandate. And if I was correct, there was about a dozen or so Democrats, Blue Dog Democrats, I think they were led by Bart Stupak, who said, listen, we're not going to sign on to this Affordable Care Act unless we are assured that there will be no funding of abortion, et cetera. And I don't know what happened there. I mean, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was promised that there would not be.
Yeah.
And of course, you get the sleight of hand and the moving around of everything, and there is. And so it's one of those things where people make promises, obviously they don't keep them. The problem, though, is when these issues are raised, because they should be important to all Americans, regardless of your beliefs or not, we don't want government encroaching in our private lives more and more, which is exactly what's going on here. And so it's a dangerous precedent to give any branch of government, but at least the legislative branch are elected and you could do something about it. But what happens if you give that right to the executive branch, who can unilaterally make laws, change laws, and do whatever they want to, it certainly sets a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, and this brings up also the issue of private property. It's not only privacy, but it's private property that matters here. Well, and I always remember seeing signs growing up, a restaurant would have a sign that they would hang on the window. We refused the right to serve anyone. And it seems to be incredibly difficult nowadays. There's another case that occurred out here in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, I believe, a bakery that refused to serve same-sex couples. They said, well, we're not going to make a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage. And they were basically pursued legally, and I think it was just a month or two ago that they said, we can't handle this anymore. We're going out of business. And it are we seeing going to see more of this with private businesses? And possibly could this extend to churches? I've had this discussion with a pastor. I said, you know, is there a point in time where they're going to say, you know, you're a church and you're using public roads and public property to, you know, for people to access your church. And you know what? You either have to perform same-sex marriages against your conscience, or we're going to yank your permit.
It absolutely is happening more and more, and will happen at churches. In fact, we're representing several clients in the same sort of issue. You talked about the bakery in Oregon. There's florists representing a photographer from New Mexico. And she was approached by someone who wanted to have a same-sex commitment ceremony to do all the photographs and the filming for the wedding. And the woman is a Christian. He said, no, that violates my religious beliefs, but I can certainly find you someone who will do so. Well, interestingly enough, they were sued under the Human Rights Act in New Mexico, and they were found to have violated the rights of this quote-unquote same-sex couple, and were forced to pay attorney fees and fines, and found to be quote-unquote discriminating. And so we talk about the reach, and people, you know, we talk about the issue of same-sex marriage, and well, you know, you can, it won't affect you at all. Well, it does affect you, and it will affect not only private businesses, but it also will affect churches. We had another case where there was an arm of the church out in New Jersey, and there's a part of the boardwalk that's privately owned. It's an area around Ocean Grove, and they had a pavilion, and they would let people use the pavilions and have weddings and things of that. And the state basically said, well, if you don't allow a same-sex commitment ceremony in that pavilion, you're discriminating. But this is owned by a church, so it violates the church's beliefs to have to do something like that. So not only is that coming, it's already here, and I think will continue to increase.
Hmm. How much protection does the Religious Freedom Restoration Act still have in determining some of these cases? I know that RFRA, as it's referred to by its acronym, was implemented in the 1990s following the Smith versus Oregon case, and it was basically an effort to put up a wall between these assaults on churches. And but that was parts of it, or maybe the whole thing was overturned later on in the Bernie versus I forgot the name of the case, City of Bernie case.
Right.
Is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act still a force to be reckoned with?
Well, it is, and what the Supreme Court struck down was its application to the states, and so it still applies only to the federal government. And it basically says that government can't burden someone's religious exercise unless it has what it defines as a compelling government interest, which is an extremely important interest. It's supposed to be likened to safety or national security or something that rises to that level. And so, yes, it still is a force. In fact, it's our main argument in these Obamacare cases that it violates RFRA as applied to these Christian business owners. And so still is there, and there are certain states that have passed what we call state RFRAs, but unless the state has passed one, you can't use that protection in that particular state unless it's against the federal government.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about these issues of healthcare mandates. We've talked about the nativity scenes praying before the city councils, et cetera, et cetera. Are there other cases involving religious freedom that we're not hitting here, that we're not seeing, that are lurking on the horizon to some extent that people should possibly be thinking of and be aware of?
Well, you know, interesting, you mentioned pastors and churches before. And we have an entire team that all they do is litigation defending churches. Hmm. And you could talk about the myriad ways that government is encroaching upon the church. One, for example, and it's fairly popular here in Georgia, where municipalities have these zoning requirements, as everyone does. But what they'll have is that churches are required to have either 3 or 5 acres in order to build a church, but nobody else has the same requirement. So if you have a small startup church you can't even meet. You can't rent a building. You can't meet anywhere unless you have anywhere from 3 to 5 acres. And most places in Atlanta and outside that area don't even have 3 or 5 acre lots available if you could afford them, which obviously churches can't. And that's a simple way of keeping startup churches out because of the unaffordability. And no other use has to abide by that, just churches and religious uses.
Mm-hmm. What about issues of tax-exempt status? I've heard rumblings before about government's running out of funds, and why are these churches getting tax-exempt status, or these parachurch organizations out in Colorado Springs with their non-governmental organization work, they're getting tax-exempt status. Why do they get that special treatment? And there's been talk about the yanking of tax-exempt status. Is that something also on the radar screen that you guys have?
Well, it is. In fact, if you look on a microcosm right now, California is trying to pass a bill aimed at the Boy Scouts, but is broader and reaches any charitable organization. And what they're doing is saying, if you, and again, we hear the word discrimination, which I think is wrongly used. It's someone who's abiding by their religious beliefs. But if you have a requirement that your organization has to be of a certain religion, like any church does, or any parachurch ministry does, or if you don't allow in, you know, homosexuals of any stripe, then you're quote unquote discriminating. And they're trying to pass a bill to take away the Boy Scouts and other organizations' tax exempt status as punishment. So obviously the next step is, well, tax exempt status for churches and other charitable ministries. And what's interesting here is I think the founders, and tax exemption obviously has gone on since the beginning of our country, and there's reasons for that. One of them is, if the courts have said, and we've all heard this, is that the power to tax is the power to destroy. And that's absolutely true. So if the government goes that route in imposing all these taxes, that's certainly the way to control and destroy the church. The second thing is that the churches, one of the reasons they are tax exempt is because they provide so much public benefit. If you look at most churches, in fact, we're representing one up in the Northeast, just to have access to public school facilities where every other community organization does, that church does more for that community than the government does or any other organization does. It's helping with the schools, it's repairing, painting and repairing air conditioning systems, it's reaching out to the poor and the homeless and trying to deal with the gang situations. And so it's not just these churches are freeloading. They are actually providing a service that I think churches should provide and the government should get out of. And I think that's the one problem. Anytime the government gets involved in anything, as we've seen, it seems to be that they mess it up. What they should do is get out of the way and allow the churches and private organizations to handle these types of issues at a tremendous saving to taxpayers, because then the churches handle these types of social issues that the government does not do well with. And what the government does is simply take one person's money and give it to somebody else. Where allowing the churches to do it voluntarily seems to me is the better way to go.
I want to leave off with this question as we close out our interview here. And that's regarding, how do churches find out about these things? A lot of the things that we're talking about, some of them make the news. The ones with prayer in front of a high school football game, that's invariably there, the nativity scenes. But a lot of these about tax-exempt statuses, about property zoning rights, well, that never makes the news. And a lot of clergy, especially the smaller non-denominational churches, they're not affiliated with any broader organization that might have their own legal counsel. The clergy, they're not trained in property rights and zoning laws. They're trained in the Gospels of Mark and Luke and such. And how do they go about finding out about these things and learning more about them?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And one of the ways is, contacting us at Alliance Defending Freedom. We've got a website that has a ton of information for churches, how to draft your bylaws, what advice do you need, how to deal with tax issues. We have a team of attorneys that represent churches all across the country on all these issues. We actually have seminars where we bring pastors in and educate them on these types of issues. So AllianceDefendingFreedom.org is our website. But we have plenty of materials, we have plenty of educational assistance, because I think that's part of the problem. Not only for churches, but for everyone, are we educated on what's going on? We hear little snippets, we hear bits and pieces in the news. Do we really know what's happening? Do we really know how the government's encroaching on our rights? And so one of the ways is to become educated, and obviously you want to go to resources such as Alliance Defending Freedom. And we are there for free. to help any church that's having a problem or advise them on how to deal with, what more and more dangerous waters that are happening in our country today.
Is this a growing industry or a growing sector of the legal profession right now? Because again, I 5, 6, 7 years ago, before I started doing research on this, I've never would have heard of such a thing. And so for me, it's a fascinating sociological examination to see how the legal landscape is changing in this direction.
Yeah, I think it is. And the reason is there's been a need for it for decades. And we've seen for so many years, beginning in the 1960s, we hear so much about cases and religion and started all in the 60s. Well, what was happening was there were very few groups from what I would call the right showing up. There were ACLU has been around for decades now, challenging everything religious, and nobody on the other side to come out and say, wait a minute, this doesn't violate the Constitution. This isn't the original intent. These practices were happening while, the First Amendment was being drafted. How could it possibly violate them? And so what's happening more and more is that individuals are stepping up and deciding, hey, we need to do something about that, and partnering with groups like ours and others like Alliance Defending Freedom and saying, look, we have to do something about that because it comes at a cost. And we talk about, well, how important is the nativity scene or how important is the kids singing a religious song? Well, which one of our constitutional rights isn't really that important? Which one can we let be encroached little by little to where there's nothing left? And I would say none. And so that thing we may see as minor, and maybe it is in comparison to other problems going on, but anytime you let that, foot in the door, then look out, because it's about to be blown wide open.
Well, as we run out of time here, I want to thank David Kortman for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me, and always good to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.